That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer pure species on the planet than the year before that.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last, the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This December 15th. 2015 edition, episode 68. Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrizin for his theme song contribution, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week, we are honored to have conservation biologist Gerardo Ceballos. Professor Ceballos is very well known as a distinguished environmental scientist. His renown is the result of, one, his pioneering and extraordinarily diverse ecological and conservation research, two, his unparalleled efforts to bring ecological knowledge to bear on crucial societal issues, three, his building of bridges between ecology and conservation in order to find humane paths to ecological sustainability, and four, his untiring efforts to increase the ecological literacy of the general public. Professor Ceballos' distinction is not based solely on his extraordinarily early accomplishments. At age 57, he is doing path-breaking research, building cross-disciplinary collaborations, educating students and postdocs, and tirelessly propagating his insights to policymakers and the public. Ceballos is a major figure in the global conservation science, carrying out strenuous fieldwork that tests the ideas in biogeography while making important contributions to theoretical and applied work on the global distributions of mammals. Ceballos has also been responsible for enormous direct contributions to the preservation of biodiversity of Mexico, a global hotspot where he has helped create protected areas equivalent to 2% of the Mexican landmass. His scientific production is exceptional. He has published 550 scientific outreach articles and 45 books. He was elected as a foreign member of the American Academy of Arts of Science and Sciences in 2014, an honor shared by fewer than 15 scientists from Latin America. Welcome, Gerardo Ceballos, to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you very, very much for inviting me. It's an honor.
Well, why don't we get started with the news of the day and the COP21 agreement in Paris? And I would, what are your general thoughts about the climate summit itself and the agreement?
Okay, well, perfect. Well, I think that the agreements were evidently short of what we all wanted and expected on the one hand. But on the other hand, I'm very happy and optimistic in the sense that for the first time in the last 20 years, we managed to get everybody on board, recognizing that global climate disruption, global warming, is a major issue that we have to work together. I have seen people not really happy about it, or they're really happy, but what I think is the starting point where we can really work hard in the next few years to make this a better agreement. So I'm extremely happy that it happened, that we managed to put the European Union, the U.S., Russia, China, Mexico, everybody else is on agreeing that this is a major issue that we have to work hard if we want to avoid a massive problem that we may face if we continue on the same path. So in that sense, I'm very, very optimistic. I'm also, I like the idea that they recognize that above 2 degrees is too much. It's just too much to have a livable Earth, and that the most important thing will be trying to reach 1.5 degrees at the most. So that's good news. I think that something that is missing in the agreement, and I think we really need to work hard, is the idea that, I mean, nobody's talking about population, human population growth, and that's the basic of all the problems. I mean, unless we curb the population, human population growth, and let we do something to stop it and start to reduce it, most of our efforts will be kind of meaningless. So on the agreements are really good, and I think now we have to start to implement them, and we have to start to talk about population, human population growth. That's a critical issue that hasn't been addressed at the global level, and very few countries have a human population policy. So in that sense, that's my summary of my feelings on that.
Well, that's pretty much the third rail of politics, isn't it? I mean, we've been hearing about overpopulation by humans since Malthus in the 1700s, and Garrett Hardin obviously was a strident voice with respect to reducing the human population, and he actually came up with some approaches that weren't completely politically infeasible, but they didn't go anywhere. And so I agree that population is a big deal and that it's not been taken seriously, at least so far, but I'm not sure it could be, given our culture of the infinite growth paradigm. What do you think about that?
That's a good point. That's a good point, because, I mean, basically, in terms of the most economic theories and most of the general society thinks that the Earth is infinite, the resources are infinite. So, but let's look. There are many places where there has been incredible progress, like even in India, that has such a horrendous population growth. The state of Kerala has a zero population growth. So basically, I think here we have to explore and look at what had worked in different places of the world and start to learn from that from those lessons, you know. And clearly, for instance, education, access to health and family planning, jobs for women and so on, has a major impact on reducing population growth. So this is a major problem, I mean, major issue, as you mentioned it. It has been discussed widely, but I haven't seen really any publication that summarizes the successes throughout the world and what it works. And basically, what I think we have to be being very bold about it is that progress can be done without changing the political, the social, or I mean, completely changing the political, the social, or the economic, the economic balance of the world. In other words, we can work with what is already available and make progress. So in Mexico, for instance, Mexico was growing really bad. I mean, the population was growing as much. It was, in relative terms, the second country with the largest growth from 1950 to the 2000 with Nigeria, and we're almost now level off. And this has been because it has been a massive program from the government and from many societies, including the Catholic Church, and to impose certain helping the local people to achieve better welfare, better social status and economic wealth by having less children. So it's a major problem, but it can be worked out. And on the other hand, this is why, for instance, it's so important, the Paris Agreement, because we don't have to, it is impossible to try to fix all the problems, environmental problems on Earth at the same time. But if we can make progress at different levels, on different steps, on all of them, for instance, global warming, with this big agreement, and then there is a big movement that I'm helping a lot on trying to curb a trade of a species, a legal trade of endangered species, that is devastating our wildlife throughout the world, and where China and some places in Southeast Asia are major players. So there's a big push, and I think in the next 2-3 years we will see a major change, a major war pressure on those countries to really do what they have to do to save those species. They have to curb their trade, they have to enforce the law, national, international law, and so on. So the idea is, and this is what I have been able to do in Mexico, and some of the studies I have published throughout the world, is to really try to use the best science to address some of these issues. And I think we need to show that conservation and development, in many cases, not on the extreme, but in many places, they can coexist. And right now, I'm sitting in a place, this is where I have a problem with this guy, because I have to come to a ranch that I have close to Mexico City. And me and my wife, we have been able to plant 160,000 trees in 1 year. And trees in some of these areas, and I see in the local community, which has been so enthusiastic about embracing these kind of things, and people is making a much profit and making a living while protecting the forest in this area. So it works, but we just have to be very creative, use science as a guiding path, and on the other hand, to try to use as much as we can of the local legislation to help these issues. The bottom line, I don't know if we're going to be successful or not, but I know that we're making progress in many fronts, and that's what it makes me kind of optimistic, that there are at least some time to do things, and this is what we have to do.
Great. So you've recently published a paper that has brought you a little bit of fame. I'm talking about the paper in Science Advances, documenting the sixth mass extinction on Earth. So can you bring us and our audience up to date on what that means? What is a mass extinction?
Yeah, that's the idea, yes. Well, first of all, this paper, it was a big surprise for us. We published it in a journal called Science Advances. That is one of the top journals in science on Earth. We basically, what we did is, there have been 5 previous mass extinctions on Earth, and all of them have 3 characteristics. All were produced by natural causes. All of those were really rapid in geological terms, a few thousand years or millions of years. And then all of them wipe out a large percentage of the animals and probably the plants on Earth. So those 5 extinctions have marked the history and the path of development, of evolution of life on Earth. And in our particular case, there has been this idea that we're entering the sixth mass extinction since 1995, when Richard Leakey published a book on that issue. He was looking at the data showing how we're losing so many species that he thought that we were entering the sixth mass extinction. And from his publication, there has been a lot of debate, how many species we're losing on Earth every year. And because the public should know that we don't know exactly how many plants and animals, different plants and animal species that are on Earth. The 2 million species have been described in the last 200 years, but we estimate that there may be 50 million, maybe 100 million different things on Earth. So by losing so many habitats, wetlands, tropical forests, temperate forests, and so on, we definitely are losing many species, but we don't know how many. So the there is this big group of deniers saying there is no extinction crisis, that this is natural, and so on. So basically what we say, and my colleagues in Stanford and in other universities in Mexico, Princeton, decide to address this issue, trying to use the most conservative data available so we can really see if there is any sign of that we're entering a mass extinction, provoked in this case by humans. So what we did is something very simple, something very complicated math that shows how many species of mammals become extinct in the last 2 million years. This is work done by Tony Barnowski at Berkeley. And basically what they found, he and his group, using evaluating thousands of records of mammals, fossils and subfossils, in the last 2 million years, they find out that you should expect two species becoming extinct for every 10,000 species alive at this present moment, every 100 years. So two species for every 10,000 species alive, every 100 years. So that's the background or normal extinction rate, and that's what we use. And this is very, very low extinction rate. Most of the extinction rate used to calculate how bad is the problem has been much, much higher. I mean, some of them even hundreds of times higher than that. So we use the most conservative one on that. And on the other hand, we also use the International Union of Conservation of Nature data for extinct species in the last 500 and the last 100 years. And the IUCN use very stringent criteria for declaring species extinct, like the species has passed 50 years without seeing it, and so on. So it's also very conservative. So anyway, we start to use those data and those analysis. And to be honest, I didn't expect we would find any signs of a mass extinction using such a conservative data. I was thinking, well, we'll see maybe some hints, but being so conservative, we're obviously underestimating the problem. And the surprise that we have is that we came out with astonishing numbers. Basically, to put it in really simple terms, all the vertebrates that became extinct in the last 100 years, on average, should have become extinct in 5,000 years. And if you use the most the extinction rates on some of those groups, the animals, the vertebrates that become extinct in they become extinct in 100 years should have become extinct in 10,000 years. That's the magnitude of the problem. And let's remember that we're using the most conservative data. So this is basically the first time in the last 3 decades, in which some research has shown with the most conservative, most solid data that we're losing species thousands of times faster than in the last previous 2 million years. And also, in the paper that we published, we were very careful, very, very, very careful, because on the one hand, we don't want to exaggerate the information. As a scientist, we have the responsibility to use the best science and explain what the results indicate. So in this particular case, the results indicate that the problem is really big. And when we compare to other groups, and after our paper, there has been published paper on insects and so on, what we found is that, indeed, we're losing species, both vertebrates and invertebrates, a much, much higher rate than in the last previous 2 million years. So our responsibility is indicated to the public that this is happening. So what's really, really exciting and surprising is that the paper became viral. It was everywhere. It was in CNN, NBC, in Europe, in Africa. I got interviews in places places like the strength of Sri Lanka, Al Jazeera in Middle East interview me when they were bumped around the place where they were broadcasting, and Argentina, Mexico, the U.S., and so on. Somebody from one of those networks told me that they estimate, because the paper was hit, the news on our paper was hit 10 million times on the webpage, that they estimate that the paper reached around 70 million people. So this is telling me that the people is interested, that the people is aware that it's a problem, and they want to do something. Because at the end of the paper, we also say that we still have time. I mean, the window of time is small, but we still have time to save lions, to save elephants, to save jaguars in Mexico, to save all those species that are becoming extinct because of our activities. And in most of the cases, it doesn't require to change the whole planet to save them. It just requires to be aware of the problem on the one hand and to act on the other, acting at the local, national level, but also acting at the international level. And I was very impressed. Yesterday I got a message in the internet from this place. It's called Altimetric. Altimetric is a place where they measure the impact of the scientific papers on the general public, on the media, on the social networks, and so on. And my paper, the paper of my co-authors and I published on this topic, is number 3 in 2015. So which so many people. So in that particular sense, it is very important that people is interested and is aware. And we have got so many requests to do things, talks, advice, some governments and so on, and some groups and some international groups, some national groups in Mexico. So what we can do? Everybody's saying what we can do. We want to act. We can, and some of them are small groups. We can act in this particular camp in Mexico, or some of them say, oh, Gerardo, what can we do to push more something to, say, the African elephants? So the scientific ideas now broadcasted through the social networks and so on can have a major impact. And I think it's our responsibility to use that enthusiasm, that interest on guiding people towards acting and do something.
Okay, we're not taking calls on today's show, so thanks to Pete from Maine for calling in, but we have a full program for today's episode. Dr. Ceballos, what triggered the previous five mass extinctions on Earth? We're in the midst of the sixth. What triggered the previous five?
The previous five were triggered by natural catastrophes. For instance, one that hasn't been recorded properly, but it's very important, is when the atmosphere of Earth changed from being more heavily based on carbon dioxide and other gases to oxygen. That caused the first major extinction. And then other extinctions have been caused, for instance, the last one was apparently caused by a huge impact of a meteorite that hit the Earth. And the information, the data that has been gathered shows that this impact was so big that it sent dust to half the way from the Earth to the Moon. Just imagine what I mean. And it caused trillions of small fires and so on. Others have been caused by volcanism. The Permian was the beginning, something like 400 and something years ago, million years ago, was probably caused by a huge activity, volcanic activity on Earth. 4,000 or 5,000 volcanoes were active at the same time, and they caused changes in the temperature, in the concentration of different gases and so on. So all the previous ones have been caused by volcanism, changes in the configuration and the depth of the seas, meteorites and so on. This particular one is caused by humans. In the previous one, there was nothing could be done to stop it because it was natural. In this particular one, we humans are causing it. So the good news is that we can analyze what are our activities that are destroying those species, ecosystems, those species, and based on that, we can act. I was recently asked in an interview by some park buddy, he said that he didn't believe that global warming was caused by humans. He said that it was a natural thing. And what I said, look, if it's natural, well done. There is nothing we can do. If it's human caused, there is a lot of things we can do because we can look what are the problems and then we can try to solve those problems. That's exactly the same with the new mass extinction. The previous ones were natural, were caused by things that couldn't be at all. Even if humans were there, there were no humans. But even if humans were there, it couldn't be done. Anything could be done because it was natural, like a big impact of this meteorite on Earth. The place where it was hit, part of the places in southern Mexico, Chicxulub, and I was at the site, and I was sitting down there one afternoon thinking how devastating could have been this massive asteroid hitting Earth. And now, without having the same impact, instantaneous impact and massive impact that we can see, we humans are acting as those previous catastrophes. If we're acting as the meteorite, or we're acting as the volcanic eruptions, or we're acting as the changes on the sea configurations and so on. So sitting down there, I was struck by the idea that we can do things. We can do a lot of things by addressing these issues. And talking about this, I mean, I recently published a book. It's called with Paul Ehrlich and Anne Ehrlich from Stanford. Those are two of my co-authors where I have been working a lot of these issues at the global level, especially population and species extinctions. And we published a book called The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinctions of Birds and Mammals, where we basically address these issues, what is diversity on Earth, how many species we have, what we know, what we don't know, then what is the status of the diversity, especially mammals and birds as an example, because they are very close to humans, and it's easy to demonstrate with animals that we care what is happening to the other animals that we don't even know. And then we talk about what are the major problems of losing those plants or animals, and then what can we do. And it's also very interesting that the book has been selling really well on Amazon. It has been, people is buying the book because they want to know what is happening. This is my reading, and they want to know what to do. And basically, in that particular group, we told stories about all the species of mammals and birds that have become extinct, all of them that are in danger, and basically, what are the causes of extinction. And one thing that I like to mention on all these issues, there are plenty of reasons to save species, philosophical, ethical, economic, and so on, to save all these species. But basically, we should save them also just because we need the company to make this planet as interesting, as incredible, as beautiful as it is. And even if we could survive with those species, it wouldn't be the same. So I think that idea has really caught the attention of many people, that there are many, many reasons. But just because we need beauty, and beauty is a really important part of the development of the human brain, of the human societies, and nature is part, the most important part of this beauty on our Earth, we need to save those species. And then we enter in the book on many other topics of why we should care about them. But I was struck that the people really got interested, that we need to save those species, those ecosystems, just because they are beautiful. And we need beauty to keep on going as humans.
Right. So it seems that the previous extinction events and this one share something in common, that both resulted from loss of habitat for organisms as a result of temperature change, whether it was a meteor blocking out the sun's rays or volcanism that led to increased global average temperature. So I'd like to quote from an interview you did shortly after your paper was published in Science Advances. The quote is, "Life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on." Why would our species likely disappear early on?
Oh, that's a good point. Well, as you point out, all the extinction, the mass extinction, has been caused by catastrophes that have affected all the planet. I mean, have environmental impacts, global environmental impacts, and this is what is causing us, what we're causing. So basically what I said in that interview is that what we have learned from the previous ones is that even they have been very massive, that they have wiped out so many species, the bottom line is that life has been able to recover. It has taken millions of years. Some of them have taken 50 million years, but life has rebound because the conditions on Earth were changed, but there was still here. So what I say here, and this is the most important part, and I'm glad you ask it, is that in this particular one, what is at stake? Even if we don't do anything, life on Earth will survive. I mean, there will be plants and animals here. It will take a long time to recover, a few million years, but life will recover and there will be life on Earth. What is at stake here is that we want this life. In this particular extinction, what is at stake is not only all these species that are disappearing, but the presence of humans on Earth. And I say that because of two reasons. On the one hand, all the species that are becoming extinct, all these species that are becoming extinct or have become extinct, are basically part of the structure and function of the ecosystems. And we know now, scientists, we know now that, and we have coined this term called ecosystem services. We know now that life on Earth is possible and human well-being is possible because of the well-function of nature. We receive a lot of benefits from nature, free benefits from nature, like the combination of the gases of the atmosphere, like the quantity and quality of our water, potable water, the fertilization of all the soils on Earth, prevention of disasters and diseases and so on. So by working properly, nature gives us a lot of benefits. Taking animals and plants from nature by becoming extinct is eroding the possibilities of nature to provide us with those environmental services. And we are, and this is from the particular point of view of plants and animals becoming extinct, we're reaching a point in which we're losing so many that we are already seeing that many ecosystems, many regions on Earth are not working properly. They are already having enormous problems. And remember that the extinctions of plants and animals, I like to remember our audience, that the extinctions of plants and animals and what we are seeing is just the tip of the iceberg. There are many more who are becoming extinct or will become extinct very soon unless we do something. We call them the zombies. The zombies are because they are living dead. There are so many species, especially of animals that we know, that there are so few of them left on Earth that basically the role on nature has been lost. So we're eroding the possibilities of nature to give us benefits, environmental services. And those species, on the other hand, let's remember that those species are becoming extinct because of many other global problems, global climate change, hunting, habitat destruction, as you mentioned, the diseases, new diseases, emerging and re-emerging diseases, pollution. I just read this morning that the island of plastic on the sea, we have seen about this island of plastic floating on the sea, is trillions of plastic pieces on our seas. So what we're seeing, the extinction of species are being caused by many other problems that if we sum them together, are pushing the capabilities of the planet to the edge where most of the scientists in many different disciplines, geologists, geomorphologists, climate scientists, and biodiversity scientists, we think that we are reaching a point in which the whole thing will collapse. I mean, this is what really worries me, because all of these species becoming extinct, all these ecosystem functioning less well, all these problems that we're seeing are summing up and are pushing so much pressure on the system and on the biological system that maintain life on Earth in general, all the life of human beings in particular, we're pushing it too hard. And all the evidence shows that there are few decades to act. This is why I say something like that in that interview. Those are the reasons, and they're very powerful reasons. This is the best science available, and all this best science available show that we're in a path in the wrong path, and we need to change that path. This is like in the book that I mentioned, we have a quote, not a quote, we have a, I remember we wrote something like, this is like in the Tolstoy great book, where the Russians are gaily dancing while the Napoleon is on, the other party is coming to tear them apart, and they are dancing happily, ignoring the problem. This is what seems to be happening now to many, to much of our society. We're like ignoring the big problems, and we seem to be going in the same path, the same direction as usual, ignoring that we're facing a massive assault on the environmental systems that maintain life on Earth.
You've been listening to conservation biologist Professor Gerardo Ceballos. We're out of time, sir. We thank you for your work and for your voice today, and there's plenty for us to think about and do, and we'd love to have you back sometime. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much for the interview. I do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Guy, you have a climate update, a rather large one.
Yes, I have an extensive climate change update this week, largely because I was traveling the previous week. Also, I'm no longer allowing comments on the monster climate change summary and update on the blog, which has been moved to a tab at the top of the blog and removed from the regular posts where the essays are. The blog was becoming increasingly unstable because of this long essay. A paper published in the October 15th, 2015 issue of Paleoceanography furthers the case for abrupt climate change. Quote, "This record reveals that the climatic shift during the early deglacial occurred rapidly, less than 700 years, in a progression of three abrupt warming steps. The onset was remarkably abrupt, with 4 to 5 degrees C sea surface warming in about 50 years. As explained by one of the paper's authors during an interview, one of the most astonishing things about our results is the abruptness of the warming in sea surface temperatures." He goes on to say, quote, "Of the 13-degree Fahrenheit total change, a shift of 7 to 9 degrees occurred almost immediately, right at the beginning." End quote. I've mentioned interactions among feedback several times on this program. These interactions produce nonlinear results. The sudden cascading nature of nonlinearities is explained nicely in a paper published in the November 11th, 2015 issue of Interface, a publication of the Royal Society. The paper is not specifically about climate change. Rather, it's about everything, including abrupt climate change. A paper published in the November 24, 2015 issue of Environment Systems and Decisions finds that switching from a typical U.S. diet to a healthier diet based on the 2010 USDA dietary guidelines accelerates environmental destruction. Seems vegetarianism has its costs, notably a large carbon footprint. In this case, the switch from typical to recommended by the USDA comes with a 43% increase in energy use, primarily due to USD recommendations for greater caloric intake of fruits, vegetables, dairy, and fish, and other seafood, which have relatively high resource use and emissions per calorie. A paper in the November 26, 2015 issue of Science Express indicates millennial-scale shifts in plankton in the subtropical North Pacific Ocean that are, quote, "unprecedented in the last millennium." The ongoing shift began in the industrial era, and it's supported by increased nitrogen-fixing cyanobacterial production. This picoplankton community shift may provide a negative feedback to rising atmospheric CO2. One of the results of the paper is quoted thusly during an interview, quote, "This picoplankton community shift may have provided a negative feedback to rising atmospheric carbon dioxide during the last 100 years. However, we cannot expect this to be the case in the future." End quote. I've added this information to feedback number 23. Further dismantling the arguments of climate change deniers, a paper in the December 4th, 2015 issue of Science Advances points out that the so-called medieval warm period wasn't particularly warm, and the warming was largely restricted to the eastern North Atlantic region. Another paper published on that same day, December 4th, 2015, indicates how rapidly glaciers have receded in the past. Specifically, a paper published in Climate of the Past indicates Greenland's glaciers are retreating at least twice as fast as any other time in the past 9,500 years. The study also provides new evidence for just how sensitive glaciers are to temperature, showing that they responded to past abrupt cooling and warming periods, some of which might have lasted only a few decades. Moving on, according to a paper in the December 6th, 2015 issue of the Washington Post, quote, "With no government action, Exxon experts said average temperatures are likely to rise by a catastrophic 5 degrees Celsius with rises of 6, 7, or even more quite possible," end quote. The, quote, "apparent sensitivity of respiration to nighttime temperatures, which are projected to increase faster than global average temperatures, suggests that carbon stored in tropical forests may be vulnerable to future warming," end quote, according to a paper published in December 7th, 2015, online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The paper suggests that hotter nights may actually wield much greater influence over the planet's atmosphere than hotter days.
and could eventually lead to more carbon flooding the atmosphere. This self-reinforcing feedback loop, increased release of carbon with increased nighttime temperatures leading to increased nighttime temperatures leading to increased release of carbon. Oh, I almost got myself caught in a loop there. That's number 60 on the large and growing list, and it's number 57 of the irreversible variety. And from December 8th, 2015, comes a study from The Guardian consistent with last week's show. I'll read the lead. Quote, an undercover sting by Greenpeace has revealed that two prominent climate skeptics were available for hire by the hour to write reports casting doubt on the dangers posed by global warming, end quote. The professors in question are William Happer, the Cyrus Fogg Brackett Professor of Physics at Princeton University, and Frank Clemente, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Pennsylvania State University. I was informed yesterday that award-winning journalist Darja Mayles, reporting about methane, registered at spot number 6 on Project Censored's 2014 compilation. Project Censored was founded at Sonoma State University in Sonoma, California in 1976, and they've been putting out news about the most censored stories. Wow. During that entire period.
Number six. That's impressive.
That is impressive.
Oh, dar.
And I mean, it's not surprising. We've known for a long time that we censor ourselves and that the media is censoring a lot of things, mm-hmm. especially if they look dire.
Right.
So good for Dar. We look forward to having him on the show in the not-too-distant future. Upon completion of the kick-the-can-down-the-road proceedings in Paris, climate scientist James Hansen correctly declared COP21 a fraud. Here's what he had to say in an interview with The Guardian. Quote, it's a fraud, really. A fake. It's just bullshit. Wow. Again, strong words and completely appropriate. Even Bill McKibben, one of the most ridiculously optimistic people on the planet, said the Paris Agreement will leave us with a quote that is, quote, will leave us with a planet that is, quote, uninhabitable. Mm. That's Bill McKibben.
Right. Bill McKibben.
Yes. These are strong words.
Yeah.
With which I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the other hand, well-known climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe said, and I quote, as a climate scientist, this is like the best Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and your NSF grant was funded without revisions, all rolled into one big package with fancy French wrapping ever. End quote.
Is she actually a climate scientist
then? Well, she's a political scientist, and she's widely recognized as a renowned climate scientist, which is odd, because Hayhoe is an associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University. She gained fame when she was featured in the initial episode of James Cameron's The Years of Living Dangerously. She is notably married to an evangelical preacher, notable primarily because she points out that climate science and Christianity are not mutually exclusive.
Mm.
But at least in the case of Dr. Hayhoe's understanding of COP21 and its outcome, reason and climate science are mutually exclusive. Ooh, there's my out loud voice again. Homo sapiens sapiens, a self-proclaimed wise ape, will need a lot more help to survive abrupt climate change than can be provided by Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the invisible white man in the sky.
With a big beard.
Now you're making me jealous. Hayhoe's magical thinking might as well invoke unicorns and pixie dust as solutions to the myriad predicaments we face. I received a couple of graduate degrees from Texas Tech University. With Hayhoe and the faculty at Texas Tech, I'm embarrassed to claim the institution as my grad school alma mater. It's time for a Michael Mann-style takedown of her work. Indeed, we'll be starting the new year with a critique of her work on the January 5th episode.
Yay!
To keep up with our future radio topics, click the tab atop the blog titled Radio Archive and Recent Video. And right up there at the top of that page is a schedule for future shows. We'd be remiss if we didn't include Michael Mann's review of COP21.
Dun, dun, dun.
Thanks for the sound effect, Mike. I can tell you've worked in movies before. The Penn State climate scientist wrote an article for Huffington Post that was published Sunday, the 13th of December, 2 days ago. True to form, Mann's piece was filled with the twin pillars of civilization, hope and malpractice. That is, wishful thinking and lies, respectively. Titled The Power of Paris, Climate Challenge Remains, But Now We're on the Right Path, Mann's article at HuffPo includes his usual adherence to the 2C political target.
Right.
He either knows 2C isn't a scientific target, which means he's ignorant, or he knows and he's lying. Either way, he's not a dependable source on the science of climate change. I'm starting to believe Mann is more a politician than scientist. Man also fails to recognize that 2C is impossible, even with near-term collapse of industrial civilization. I'm going to read a few quotes from Mann's article and then respond to each of them in turn. I think Mann's words provide sufficient evidence of malpractice, as if more were needed after last week's show. Quote, "With the Paris summit, we finally have an agreement that holds all countries accountable for taking action on climate," end quote. No, we don't. I don't know how to be more clear about this. Voluntary changes are requested, and the agreement has no power to enforce violators. And they're supposed to start in 2020.
I think that everybody thinks that guilt's going to enforce it.
Yeah. Yeah, because the people pulling the strings of empire feel bad.
Right.
About picking on people of color? What? Eh. Okay, another quote. "The Paris Agreement gets us roughly halfway to where we need to be." That's a direct quote from Mann's article in HuffPo. "The Paris Agreement gets us halfway to hell. I disagree with the notion that we need to be there. But if you're Satan's pudgy little helper, you might believe otherwise."
Ouch. So I don't know exactly. What does that mean? Halfway to what? What does he think? Is he commenting on the 1.5? I don't know what that even means.
He thinks we need to hold it below 2. He keeps adhering to that 2-degree target.
And we're at 1 now.
And that's not the halfway part. The halfway part is we're halfway to emissions cuts that will bring us to 2C.
Right.
But we aren't. 2C is already baked in. We've known that for years. Even Hansen, with his conservative approach, in a paper from late 2011, points out that collapse of industrial civilization causes 1.2 plus minus 0.2C temperature rise.
Yeah.
We're at 1 already. That takes us over 2.
So does man ever talk about what's baked in or what the lag is or any of that?
Not that I've seen.
Yeah. Well, if he has, it's clearly not in the talking points that he generally brings up that we've covered, you know, when he was on RT or he was on Bill Maher. He generally brings up the same things. You know, he has his script, so to speak, and those things are not within his script.
Right, and it reminds me a lot of politicians when they're on the stump.
Yeah.
Right, they have these same 12 talking points.
Right.
And if they don't have enough time, they use the top 4.
Yeah, and he knows those talking points well.
Right.
It's just a little mantra, I guess.
Well, and here's what he does say in this article. "The reductions agreed upon in Paris reduce the projected temperature change to about 3.5 degrees Celsius." And so that's what he means when we're halfway there, because we have to keep it to 2.
Right.
But they're going to get us to 3.5. Okay. So we've never had humans on Earth at 3.3 above baseline, much less 3.5. And man continues to ignore self-reinforcing feedback loops. That 3.5 that he thinks we're headed for is based strictly on carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Right.
Never mind methane, never mind...
And that, again, is an end of the century and beyond type scenario.
Right. Yeah. Right, absolutely. It's always a problem for the grandchildren.
Right.
Mann also continues to ignore the well-documented evidence that civilization is a heat engine, ditto for humans depending upon a living planet to survive. These details are critical. Ignoring them is equivalent to crying out flesh wound after both arms and legs have been chopped off with a sword. Feel free to laugh along if you're familiar with the reference from Monty Python. The rest of you need to go back and watch the real stuff. Okay, so another quote from Michael Mann. "There is light now at the end of the tunnel and hope that we can not only can, but indeed already are rising to the challenge," end quote. This is pure refined bullshit from an outstanding artist of the bullshit trade. The light at the end of the tunnel is the light you've heard about during near-death experiences. I don't recommend going toward that light.
Don't go to the light.
Fortunately, the only challenge to which we are rising is the acceleration of near-term human extinction.
So I guess my question for all these individuals, if we would, you know, if they would ever come on the show, which they won't, is what is your line in the sand? What is your, you know, the point of no return for you? I mean, everybody has one. Clearly, sometimes the one you have, you're not willing to say publicly. But even then, publicly, you would have one. It's just more conservative. That's the question. That would be the first question I think I would ask somebody like Michael Mann is, or Bill McKibben. What has to happen where you go, we're fucked?
Right.
Is there such a thing?
I mean, McKibben, for example, 350 is the organization he led for a long time, 350.org, says 350 is a line in the sand.
Right.
We're never going to see 400 again in our lifetimes.
Right.
We passed that.
But that's a lot of bumper stickers you got to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, even waiting out the 3 and putting in 4.
The 403 just doesn't have a ring.
No, it doesn't really. I mean, James Hansen presented 350 as a reasonable upper bound, an absolute upper bound in 1988.
Yeah.
In 1988.
Right.
And we blew right through that, and we recently blew through 400. And there's no going back at this point.
But even he still thinks that we can be safe with nuclear power.
Well, yeah, because we're addicted to electricity. We can't possibly threaten this set of living arrangements.
Right. So that being said, did you have a specific point of no return that kind of hit, and you went, we're not coming back?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I came to the conclusion that we were headed for human extinction by 2030 or so in 2002 when I was editing a book on climate change. And then just a year or so later, I discovered the concept of global peak oil. And I thought, well, here it is. Here's the Hail Mary that's going to save us. This will terminate civilization rapidly enough that we can turn off the heat engine. This was long before Tim Garrett published any of his papers on civilization as a heat engine. So it was 2003, maybe 2004. Yeah, the book was published in 2004, where I talked about peak oil and terminating civilization as a result. And it took me a long time, actually, until June 20th, I believe, of 2012.
The
20th. The kind of stuff that sticks in my head is really annoying to you and me, trust me. So it took me a long time to have those self-reinforcing feedback loops overcome me. And at the time, there were 5 of them. And the real kicker for me was atmospheric methane going exponential, and particularly the clathrate gun being fired. So it took me several years after 2004, 8 years after 2004, before I again was back at the point I was in 2002, mm-hmm. which is that we crossed too many planetary boundaries to come back from this.
How about Garrett? Does he even talk about dismantling civilization? Does he have hope in some aspects? Because he writes, you quote him often, but where does he stand?
Yeah, it's interesting. I invited him to come on the show and also to participate in a webinar that somebody was putting together for me, and he wouldn't have anything to do with that, either of them, because mm-hmm. he doesn't agree that human extinction is going to occur in the near term, mm-hmm. however we define that, yeah. even if it's 100 years out. And oddly enough, this from the leading voice on civilization as a heat engine, yeah. he told me in an email message that he thinks the climate is much more sensitive to our carbon emissions than most people believe. So talk about cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, right.
I mean, only collapse prevents runaway climate change because civilization is a heat engine.
Right.
But I don't really mean that. That's what all the evidence says, but I don't believe it myself.
What institution is he affiliated with?
He's at the University of Utah.
Well, there we go. It's an institution.
It is an institution, that's right. And with that comes consequences for saying anything, really. I was interviewed by Press TV during the final hours of COP21. As you can imagine, my take differs from that of Catherine Ahejo and Michael Mann. The whole show around COP21 was only a show, and the willfully ignorant masses fell for it, as usual, just like they've done the previous 20 times. You can find my 4-minute radio interview with Press TV on the blog in my post from yesterday, Monday, the 14th of December, 2015. And actually, I was interviewed several times in the final hours or at the close of COP21. Mm-hmm. And I'll be posting another one of those interviews in my next blog post as well.
Okay. Standard interviews, standard questions you normally get?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, essentially everybody who interviews me at this point knows my position, mm-hmm. that we're headed for the abyss. And they just want me to tell them that COP21 saved us.
Mm.
No, really. They say something like, so we know what you've said before, but COP21 is being hailed as a major accomplishment, and so surely you're going to back down.
Right.
You know, I mean, they don't put it in quite those words.
Does anybody ever ask you what it literally, like, you know, what would have to happen at a conference like that for you to go, all right, they're in some sense a reality?
No, nobody ever asked me that because
the question is nothing.
Well, not only that, we've triggered all these self-reinforcing feedback loops, right?
But they could get together by some miracle and say, we're going to dismantle civilization.
Right, exactly. And I would think that would be an excellent idea, even in light of the self-reinforcing feedback loops, even in light of the evidence for abrupt climate change because of firing the clathrate gun in past mass extinction events. So I'm still a huge fan of dismantling industrial civilization, but I no longer think it's about us,
the
so-called wise ape.
It's never been about us, has it?
Except for those of us who think it is.
All right, folks. Well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And we'll see you next week on the radio, next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. As always, it'll be a call-in show this time. Not always, I guess, but next week we speak with Mark Austin, former student of Guy's at the University of Arizona for nearly two decades ago, and more recently, government contractor and truth teller. Should be an excellent show. And we thank our guest today, Professor Dr. Gerardo Ceballos, conservation biologist, for his time and his words and his work, of course. If you can't find us or you didn't get the chance to listen this time, make sure to find us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks again for your calls, although we didn't take any. But, hey, it's worth the effort, right?
Next time.
And to Afrozit for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
She's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.